So, yes, just sort of following up on that, has the work you've done on aerial transmission, airborne transmission, changed policy in, for instance, in this country? You've told me what's happened in WHO.
I think the work I did on masks, I think, did have some influence on the policy decision to introduce masking in July 2020. I think the work I've done on airborne transmission has had some influence, but I think, to be honest, what's happening in the UK at the moment, speaking in early November 21, is we seem to have gone into a policy of relying on vaccination and assuming that we now can drop all other measures. So the question of whether this is an airborne virus or a droplet virus has rather been parked, because it's now seen to be a virus that's controlled by vaccination. And there is a narrative that we have uncoupled the transmission of the disease from severe effects of the disease. That is not a view I personally hold. It's only a couple of days since we had nearly 300 deaths in this country. You know, we're regularly getting over 200 deaths a day. And yet it is assumed that because everyone's vaccinated, or many people are vaccinated, it's not a serious disease anymore. We've kind of conquered it. That is highly, highly problematic. I am very, very troubled by this concocted truth, in inverted commas. I wish the debate on mode of transmission was front and centre, but it is not currently, which is a great shame.
I think, well, we've talked about this a bit, but I could just focus on why you think it's been so difficult for medical science as a whole. Oh no, actually, there's another question I want to ask first. Evidence-based medicine. I remember when the phrase kind of first came in, and everybody thought, oh, what a good thing, we've gone from this time when it was all kind of suck it and see it based on personal experience, mm-hmm. to a time where treatments are based on evidence. But the term almost seems to have broken down in a way, because you have to question what is evidence, how do you decide what evidence to pay attention to. What's your view on that?
It's very, very interesting, isn't it? I think evidence-based medicine was a very clever piece of marketing. And actually Muir Gray, who's an Oxford professor, claims to have developed the term evidence-based medicine to kind of market the ideas of clinical epidemiology. And clinical epidemiology says, if you want to make a treatment decision in an individual patient, or indeed a diagnosis decision, you should be taking account of research into populations. You shouldn't just be treating the patient on the basis of whether the previous patient got better on a particular drug. Now, I think we're all signed up to that, but that doesn't mean that the methods and evidence hierarchies that are appropriate for assessing the efficacy of drugs or the accuracy of diagnostic tests apply to every aspect of anything health related. And I think the evidence hierarchy of evidence-based medicine has been naively misapplied to dismiss aerosol science. And if you go back to what I was saying about interdisciplinarity and how my own personal doctoral work shifted from a biochemical focus to a much broader, you know, anthropological focus, and I think we need people who can change horses, change disciplinary horses when it's needed. And the problem with evidence-based medicine is it's really just code for clinical epidemiology, and it is a unidisciplinary perspective which favours epidemiology. And we don't need epidemiology, or at least it shouldn't have an exclusive or a privileged position. I mean, epidemiology of COVID is very important, but when the question is the virus airborne, you need aerosol scientists. You don't need clinical epidemiologists because they're not trained to do that. This seems to me to be such a basic thing. I honestly cannot, well, I can understand why people got it wrong, because it's all about the link between science and power, but it's something I think future historians are going to look back and say, gosh, even with so much research funding, so much scientific evidence, they still completely drop the ball there.
That's great, thank you. I think again you mentioned this a bit, but we can develop it a bit. To what extent have you personally felt threatened by the infection, either in the initial phase or more recently?
Oh, I've taken this infection very seriously, and I haven't had it. I have, you know, I'm a cancer survivor. I've been very sick with sepsis in the past, and I don't want to repeat that experience. Because I was convinced from an early stage that this virus was airborne, I have not been on public transport since the beginning of the pandemic. I have only been into my department 3 or 4 times. Every single time was on a Sunday or late at night when there wasn't anyone else in the building. And I have been to very, very few face-to-face meetings, maybe 2 or 3 since the beginning of the pandemic, because I don't want to catch it. So, you know, I haven't personally had it. As I said, my mother died of it. My son had what was actually pretty mild COVID. He said it wasn't very nice at the time, but, you know, 10 days later he was better. And I think the way COVID affected me, apart from losing my mother, was an awful lot of my staff were affected by lockdown and furloughed, you know, or were homeschooling their kids, that kind of thing. And I think I'm not alone in that, but certainly it was a bit of a struggle. But, you know, that was a sort of indirect, really, you know, physically. I've been completely unscathed.
Again, you've answered this one, but you could perhaps, again, develop it, say how it panned out later. Did you work longer hours than normal during the pandemic?
Yeah, no, crazy hours, absolutely crazy hours. And in fact, someone asked me recently, what would you have done differently if we could kind of play that first few months of the pandemic again? And I said I would have taken more breaks because we were working at an extraordinary pace, an absolutely blistering pace. I published more than 50 papers in 2020. You know, it's 1 week. It was crazy. And actually, I published over 40 this year and it hasn't finished yet, so it hadn't got much better. But actually, of those first 50 papers, you know, I'm talking to you about 5 or 6 of my papers. There were an awful lot of papers that weren't that good, actually, looking back. And although every single one of them was done in good faith and we tried hard, I think if we'd taken a step back, taken a weekend off from time to time or something like that, we may have done fewer pieces of work but done them slightly better. Having said that, I don't think we would have known at the time which ones we should have focused on and which ones we shouldn't. Because that first masks paper, the one for the precautionary principle, it only took a couple of days to write. We didn't know it was going to go viral. we didn't know masks were going to be such a big thing. So I think it's all very well with the retrospectoscope, isn't it? But in the fast unfolding of events, it was quite hard to know what to focus on.
Mm-hmm. And how, I mean, you said it was 5 months that you had this extremely intense period. The implication being that since then, you haven't been going at quite such a blistering pace, but on the other hand, you have produced, continued to produce a huge number of papers. So did you actually get a chance to take time off, or did you institute a regime of regular breaks from that point on?
I've had 2 weeks holiday in the last 2 years, and I've got another one booked the week after next, actually, so that'll be 3 weeks in 2 years. So that's not very much. On the other hand, it's quite hard to go on holiday at the moment. I do stop now most evenings. I think the pace of work, I think doing 16-hour days was crazy, so now I only do 12-hour days. But there's still plenty of work to do, mm-hmm. actually. And also, although, you know, I'm working long hours, as I said, I don't feel particularly stressed by it now. It's quite fulfilling. I'm finishing off quite a lot of projects that have been running for a few months. Mm. I'm finding it quite sort of comfortable intellectually. There's some very, very interesting philosophical work that I haven't talked about much, but for example, I've been linking up with some pragmatist philosophers because I think pragmatism is a really, really interesting theoretical lens to look at the pandemic through. So one of the papers I've got under review at the moment is around crisis policy making through a pragmatist lens. That's almost like a hobby, and it's very different from the kind of work I was doing right at the beginning of the pandemic, which was very much about how can we stop people dying today and tomorrow. I've now shifted gear a bit and started thinking, wait a minute, what does this pandemic tell us about pandemics generally, or crises generally? And that, I think, is quite rewarding and productive. And you know, you can see I don't feel particularly stressed right now. I had time to do this interview. If you'd asked me to about this 18 months ago, I'd have said, sorry, I haven't got time. So I think things are settling down a bit.
Have you, is there anything that you do within your group to kind of support the emotional well-being of your colleagues?
That's a really interesting one, isn't it? I am cynical about some of the emotional well-being stuff that goes around. So we have this email that comes around every Wednesday, and the headline is Well-Being Wednesday, and it says things like, take 20 minutes away from your work, and all that kind of thing. It's too formalised, it's too technocratic, it's like going on a resilience course. I think the way I have tended to do it is picking up a lot of bitty things that people weren't coping with, and so I would pick them up and, you know, help them with it. Various people, various of my early career researchers had been slogging away at a paper for months and not being very productive because of all the stuff that was going on. And I've had more input to those papers than I would normally have had, but I've made sure that they got the paper finished, submitted and published, so they've got the line on the CV. I actually think that kind of input is a lot more helpful than let's all have a virtual coffee morning. Although we do virtual coffee, it happens once a week. They tend to do it without me, actually. Some people find it very helpful, some people don't. I've done a couple of other things with my group. I'm friends with a Danish academic called Nina Meyer, And Nina has an interest in the support of early and mid-career researchers. That's one of her research interests. And she was in a situation where she wasn't doing a massive amount of pandemic-related work, and she had a bit of extra time during the pandemic, and she said, is there anything I can do? And I said, well, can you do some sessions for my team? So she did some virtual sessions on academic writing and helped individual members of my team with some of their papers and gave them feedback on drafts of writing. And they found that enormously helpful. I think mainly because Nina is wonderfully gentle and slightly motherly in a nice way, if I can say that. And it was because it wasn't me helping them, I think. They were sort of saying, you know, Tris is kind of going off saving the planet. We've got this protected space with Nina, who's not doing pandemic stuff. She is committed to us. And actually, I used some of my pandemic money to pay her for that. Now, talking of pay and money, we also responded, we applied for University of Oxford pandemic funds to return people to work after the pandemic. Now, we had lots of different people with different problems and challenges, but what I did was I helped, I think, 7 or 8 members of my team each to apply for £5,000, and we used that money to pay the salary of somebody who came in as a research assistant, and they used her time flexibly, however they wanted. So they said, please, I want you to help me do the background work for a grant application. I want you to help me finish this paper. And it was good for the research assistant because that person had come to the end of a contract and would have been made redundant. But it was also good because I said to people, I don't care what you do. I don't even want to know. Here's an extra pair of hands. And people would say, oh, that's brilliant. That's just what I need. And they would come up with an idea for using this person's time, which was far better than what I would have come up with. So practical help was important. What else?
Sounds like pragmatism again.
Yeah, it's very pragmatic. But then pragmatism, it's not just about being practical. It does have a kind of philosophical underpinning, which is something I'm getting quite interested in, but I daren't say it onto this tape because I'm actually a novice on pragmatism and I'd probably get it all wrong.
So were you involved in your institution or department's COVID safety regime?
No. I offered to be.
Yes.
But I was told that I wasn't needed.
And were you satisfied with how it was implemented?
No. There's droplet theatre everywhere, which is why I don't go in. I'm quite gobsmacked, actually, at the way in which droplet theatre has dominated Oxford's response and the way airborne precautions have not been taken on. I think yesterday or the day before, we published a new paper, peer-reviewed in Wellcome Open Research, all about getting back to campus, you know, returning to on-site teaching. It was a rapid, systematic review of the literature on what should be done. The most important thing is vaccinating staff and students and getting vaccination levels up to 90% if we can. The next most important thing is instigating airborne precautions, including masks, etc., etc. And that, we published it, or a version of it, through the UCU, through Universities and College Union. It was sent to every member of UCU, and it's now been published as a peer-reviewed journal with a few more references. But it hasn't kind of hit the desks of the people who are running the response. And my emails, I don't think I've had replies to them. So, yeah, that's sad. That's sad. On the other hand, if we talk about emotional well-being, you know, in the end, you can only do your best. In the end, if they're not going to take any notice. I remember when I was a junior doctor, I used to cry myself to sleep when a patient died, and someone took me aside and said, you're never going to survive in medicine. You did what you could do, and if someone came in with crushing chest pain and you gave them the right drugs and you got the drip into the vein and you know, you were there and you put the monitor on and they still died, they were going to die, and it's not your fault. And I sort of take a bit of the same approach here, is that if you can't do that, you're going to go crazy. So I've done my best. I've made my offer. I've published these very high profile papers. And if they choose to ignore it, you know, I'm not going to beat myself up.
You mentioned earlier that your public profile, that you've been on telly a lot. How have you felt about that both in conventional and social media? You're now a name that's known much more widely than it was.
It's not something that I was seeking out. I don't court the media. I don't have an agent. I say no to 90% of requests. And I've very much narrowed down. So people will phone me up. They've all got my mobile number. They say, please, will you be... I got a phone call yesterday. Please, will you be on Good Morning Britain tomorrow? And then you say, well, what's it for? And they'd say something. You think, well, I could talk on that subject, but I'm not the world's expert on it. And it's not what I'm known for. So I will say, no, I'm not going to talk on that. I'll talk about masks and I'll talk about airborne precautions and that's it. And I'll talk actually about remote care. Because they can go and find someone else to talk about the other stuff. But actually, in recent weeks, I've refused all media. And that's partly because, although I'm not feeling particularly stressed, it actually stresses my family, it stresses my husband. And it's often they want you at 10 o'clock at night, and then they'll keep you waiting, so you're actually not on till 10:45. And then it's actually quite hard to get to sleep after you've done live TV. So I've done quite a bit. It's very time consuming. I don't like the attention. I don't like, if I've done a TV appearance, I then get 20 emails from people saying, can you do local radio tomorrow? And I don't like the abuse. I haven't talked much about the abuse,
yeah,
but
I was going to ask you about the abuse. Yeah, I don't need explicit examples, but I mean, it's something that anybody with a high Twitter profile has
I think
with.
So I think the masks thing has been the worst. People have systematically set up groups to attack me. There are the sort of dark websites of libertarian groups. I know that I'm on their list. So, for example, one person will put out a tweet reply to one of my tweets, and within minutes there'll be 200 replies. All saying very much the same thing, as if they've been told that this is the version to use, and sometimes it's identical text. And you just think, I've got better things to do with my time than engage with that. And I go around blocking people, but this is not what I want to spend my time doing.
It's time consuming.
It's time consuming. It's exhausting. It upsets my husband because he doesn't, there was someone put out on Twitter the other day that I should be raped with a bayonet. Well, you know, that's all very well. I just think, well, that's what 14-year-olds say about women they don't like. It really didn't bother me that much, but my goodness, you know, it upset my nearest and dearest. So, I don't really want to spend my time inviting that kind of thing. I don't lose a lot of sleep over it. I just try to avoid it.
You find, in general, you have found Twitter a useful
yeah,
tool.
Because I control, I block people. I use mass blocking tools sometimes to block everybody who follows a particular extreme libertarian. I think, well, if they're following that person, I don't want them to have anything to do with me, so I'll block 500 of them or something. And then I have to apologise sometimes, because sometimes people have followed them and then they've forgotten they're following them and they don't agree with them. So I have to kind of unblock people, but yeah, that's what you have to do. Oh, is it okay? No, we're all right. We're all right. Got another 10 minutes.
So have you... I'm just clarifying this. I think we talked about it a little bit earlier, but are you not associated directly with any policy-making body at the moment?
Oh, goodness. Now, I'd better get this right, hadn't I? Until quite recently, I sat on a committee at the World Health Organization, but it wasn't the one that was dealing with the COVID response.
Right.
So it was the Alliance for Health Policy and Systems Research. I sit on, I think last count, about 13 national committees. I am on the Long COVID National Task Force. I was on the NICE oversight group for the Long COVID guideline. I've done various pieces of work with the, what's it called, NHS England Digital Primary Care. Primary Care Digital Transformation Team, that's what it is. Primary Care Digital Transformation Team, I think I'm an official advisor to them. So, you know, one works with policymakers, yes. But I'm not on any of the formal COVID, the ones that are, shall we say, in the public eye, in relation to COVID.
Like SAGE and
I'm not on SAGE, I'm not on NERVTAG. I applied to be on SAGE actually, and I was told that my expertise wasn't appropriate, which I think is quite funny. what are the other ones? I'm not on any of those, no. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even on independent SAGE, which is quite interesting, because often when you've got a high profile scientist who's not on SAGE, you'll find that they are on independent SAGE. Mm-hmm. But I have appeared on independent SAGE, you know, their broadcasts, because, you know, I've gone there as a guest. So I'm friends with them, shall we say.
So has the work you've done raised new questions that you might be interested in exploring in the future?
Yeah, I think all the stuff around pragmatism. Mm-hmm. I've just put in a grant to the MRC and NIHR for funding to appoint a postdoctoral philosopher to look at how pragmatist philosophy can help us in these very action-oriented research approaches where you've got to generate stuff in real time, interpret it, apply it, all in a big sort of unfolding jumble, if you like. And that's interested, that is the thing that's most grabbing me at the moment, actually. Yeah.
This is the last question. Has the experience of COVID changed your attitude or approach to your work, and are there things that you'd like to see change in the future?
That's a really interesting question, and it's the out of all the questions you've asked me, it's the only one I haven't got an immediate answer for. And I think it's because I'm still too close to it. I think if you asked me in a year's time, I would know. But it's because I'm still experiencing COVID, I think. What on earth is going to happen in the future? I don't know. I mean, I've got an application which I doubt will be funded, which I put in about 9 months ago for a Leverhulme senior fellowship to write a book about Wittgenstein. There was a a friend of Wittgenstein who was a doctor who wrote a book called The Danger of Words. It's a the chapter called Maurice Drury, and it's all about how some of Wittgenstein's insights are very relevant to medicine, and I applied to Leverhulme to write a modern day version of that book, because actually it was written in the 1950s, early 60s, I think. And medicine's changed hugely, but actually some of the work of the later Wittgenstein would be incredibly relevant. Now, I put that in thinking I would, if I got it, I could then spend 3 years writing a book and then retire, because I'm 62 now. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And then I thought, would I actually do that? Because I would have thought, I mean, when I wrote the application, I thought the pandemic would be over by now. Whereas actually the pandemic's now grumbling along, and there's all sorts of, you know, terrible things happening. Like, we're dropping all precautions because of the, you know, the idea that we think we're vaccinated, so that's that. Can I really kind of just go and sit in the Bodleian and write a book about Wittgenstein, even if I get funding? I'm not sure. I really don't know what the answer to that is. It'd be interesting. Anyway, that'll my hand will probably be forced because they probably won't fund it, but it would be a big change. It'd be a complete transformation if I did get it.
Thank you very much.
That'll do, won't it? Okay.